Radio City, once again, episode number 49. We are nigh on episode L, which will come along next week. Here, John Grace and Rob Ross with you, but as 49 kicks off, boy, we've got so much going, and the world of pop culture especially has been rocked over the last couple of weeks, and even over just these last few days, by death after death after death, and now we're hearing one name associated with all of them, and that name is fentanyl. Now blamed in the deaths of not only Tom Petty, but Dolores O'Riordan from the Cranberries.
Yeah, and first, I have to say that when I heard people talking about fentanyl on Friday, I didn't realize that they were talking about that it was announced that it was the main culprit behind Tom Petty's death.
Yep.
Which, you know, I have to be honest, it really angered me in many, many ways. Angered by the fact that, you know, we've lost Tom Petty and he was a hero of mine. That kind of goes without saying, but I feel the same way about losing Pat D'Anizio or Grant Hart or Tommy Keane, all under different circumstances, liver cancer, heart attack. You know, the fact that Tom Petty died in such a – I know I'm probably going to catch flack for saying it, but such a cliched way, even though the fentanyl was prescribed – to endure the pain of having a fully broken hip.
Right. That he had toured with. And that's the important thing. I mean, he was coming off a tour and had been home for all of, what, 2 days before he died? So he was obviously in some trouble, but it wasn't the kind of trouble that we've heard. I mean, the guy was a big pot smoker, but that's about all we knew. And right. So this wasn't anything that was a long-term addiction problem or anything else like that. He was taking a drug for a prescribed cause and it killed him.
Right. He died of a massive heart attack brought on by this medication. I mean, it didn't help the fact that he also smoked like a chimney and never slowed down.
Right.
That, of course, will help things, I'm more than sure. But, you know, Prince died of a fentanyl overdose. So, you know, and he had that hip replacement surgery. So you knew that he was not in good physical shape. But the point being that this drug has now become the catalyst for taking artists – simply because it's been prescribed to them, but they never seem to know when the prescribed amount is enough.
Right. And with the Dolores O'Riordan thing, it's going to take a little bit longer to sort out, I think. I mean, they had canceled that tour last year because of some problems that she had, other physical problems. And who knew? I mean, she had suffered from depression that was brought on by years of sexual abuse when she was a little kid. And so she was dealing with a lot. And whether that fentanyl overdose in her case was something that was self-inflicted or whether it was something that was accidental, we may never know, but the fact is that we lost another amazing performer.
And then, you know, unspoken or overlooked or whatever you want to call it, very few people have brought up the fact that last week we lost Fast Eddie Clark of Motorhead,
yep,
which now leaves no members of the original trio on this planet. And it's... no matter how you slice it, it doesn't matter the fact that, well, we all get old and we all die. That, yeah, I'm a little bit more than aware of that being in my 50s. But the fact is, you know, it's still no less of a painful loss. I would feel the same way about it if, God forbid, Paul McCartney or Paul Weller or, you know, anyone whose music touched me, moved me and influenced me were to suddenly go.
Right.
And now... 48 hours ago, we learned about the tragic death of Jim Rodford, who, if you don't know his name, was one of the most beloved and well-liked and respected and greatest bass players ever. He played with Argent. He was the cousin of Rod Argent. He played with the Kinks for many, many years, from about 78 onward till their final dissolution in 96, and was playing in the Reconstituted Zombies when Chris White wasn't doing the Odyssey and Oracle set.
Yep. Not to mention the fact that he happened to be our guest at our table following the Zombies concert in Milwaukee just about a year ago. And we got to buy drinks for him and a bunch of his mates. And he came over and sat with us for a while and told some stories and was a tremendously, tremendously nice guy. In fact, we didn't even make a big announcement about it. The Zombies walked into the bar after the show and sat down at a table. And one of them went up to the bar and ordered drinks. And I just quietly said to the bar manager, "Hey, charge that to my room." And she did and went over to the table and brought him their drinks and, you know, told him who it was. And after the others had gone up to their rooms, Rodford came over and said, well, if somebody's going to buy my drinks, I'm going to sit down and meet them. And was the nicest guy and had some great stories. I'm very, very sad to hear that he's gone.
I remember you telling me that story and feeling so warm about it. And then the stories about Colin Blunstone and Rod Argent and Chris White, you Grundy. I mean, man, that's one of those dream come true moments. But, you know, the fact that in this case, he fell down a flight of stairs. I mean, there's another one of those moments proving that it's all ephemeral, you know?
Right.
It was a sad weekend. It really was. I mean, I was primed and ready for us to have no end of laughs and sardonic comments with our rapier likes, wit and tongues. Anything going on in St. Louis yesterday I should be aware of? Because as far as I'm concerned, in my little world of Staten Island, nothing happened.
Right. And it's been fairly quiet around here, too. The only thing that has been tough to keep track of is what you're supposed to wear when you walk outside, because 4 days ago it was zero and now it's 70. So I can't.
Wow, you got to 70. We're about at mid-50s.
Yeah.
But it's comfortable.
Yeah, and for January, almost February, I guess we can count our blessings here, but still. Now, it's been fairly quiet around these parts. The one thing that everybody keeps talking about is the governor, and it's interesting. The last time we talked, we mentioned that Eric Greitens, and if you missed that show, Eric Greitens, the governor of Missouri, former Navy SEAL, father of two married guys, only been married once, but he had admitted to an affair. And on top of the affair, it was alleged by the girl that he was sleeping with, who was also married, was, I stress, she is now divorced. She said that he had blackmailed her and took naked pictures of her and said if she ever told anybody, he'd release them. Now it comes out this week that when she told him that she was reconciling with her husband and was sleeping with him again, Greitens is now alleged to have slapped her across the face. And that story goes on and on. The one thing that happened this week that was a little different is he has not, much as Donald Trump hasn't on the national scale, Eric Greitens has not exactly ingratiated himself with the Republican majority in the Missouri legislature. So several of the members of his own party turned on him this week and are calling for his resignation. He's still not doing it, but it just goes to show that if you don't play along, if you don't go along to get along in that game, they will turn on you at the first opportunity. So it may be very thin ice right now for Eric Greitens. So that's been kind of fun to watch.
Interesting. Very interesting. I heard about this Republican fellow in Pennsylvania. And it's the first Republican I've heard in a while, save for this particular case, but the first Republican I've heard in a while that's actually being called out for quote-unquote sexual harassment.
Yeah.
Using taxpayer dollars to fund his own defense to quash this.
Oh, yeah. Well, that seems to be the hot rumor with Greitens, too, is that they're poking around his campaign finances right now to find out if he paid her off to keep quiet during the campaign. So no word on that yet, but that's where the investigation seems to be leading.
Never a dull moment, is there?
No.
I'm telling you, we missed our calling. I think we should have gone into politics because at least we could get away with murder and we would have made a buttload of money.
Right. Absolutely. No, there are some things going on elsewhere in the world, though, that bear our attention.
Nothing happened yesterday.
Not the least. Yeah, right. The government shutdown. Oh, for crying out
Not
loud.
That.
What?
You know, that other thing that didn't happen.
What'd I miss?
Exactly.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, the rest of the world is eating Tide Pods. So I guess, you know.
Yes. 1,000 times yes.
In between fentanyl and Tide Pods, none of us may survive this week. So it's okay. Hey, this may be our last broadcast.
Listen, if you can drink some Clorox every now and then and get away with it, washing down your goldfish, that's all well and good. That's the way we used to do it when I was in college.
You know, all it brought me back to was the movie Up in Smoke, Cheech and Chong's first movie together, and the Ajax lady who snorted a bunch of Ajax in the kitchen and went nuts. I mean, I look at this as nothing more than thinning the herd. If you're stupid enough to chomp down a Tide Pod and you die, oh well, Darwin was right.
Well, what did I say? Did I not even quote Dickens? If they're going to do it, let them do so so it can decrease the surplus population.
Exactly. So yeah, I'm fine with it.
I will be more than happy myself to drive around with cases of Tide Pods for anybody who wants to eat them. You hungry? God bless you.
There you go. Well, and the one good thing that has come out of this is all of the photoshopped fake ads for things like Tide Pod flavored Oreos, Tide Pod cereal. Those things are fucking hilarious.
That's brilliant. But I have to be very, very straight laced with you about this one, because otherwise I'm just going to burst into laughter. Leave it to our crack, or on crack, local newspaper, the Staten Island Advance, to run a video clip yesterday and then ask our, you know, the general consensus opinion of what we think of this whole Tide Pod eating.
Are they really?
Place, right. But John, the best part about this was, and I'm not kidding, this video was shot by a group called Human People Against Eating Tide Pods. Now, Human People Against Eating Tide Pods. Now, I want to know one thing. Did you ask the Saturnalians? Did you ask?
Right.
Was a Martian, a local Martian, even consulted? Because I know we have them here.
Well, yeah. I mean,
they didn't need to worry about, you know, a wall or border guards.
Is there no way to contact the Raelians or those idiots who killed themselves so they could fly behind the comet? You know, hey, there's got to be something. Somebody outside the planet we can ask about this.
Human people against. I once again. Just when you think you've seen everything in life.
It's not even a good acronym.
Human people, though. Human people. I mean, if I ask my cats, I don't think they're going to give a single shit. Your dog is not going to care.
And the thing is, not to take any of the emphasis off of this thing, it's a ridiculously stupid story to begin with. But what are there, a dozen of these things? I mean, a dozen kids, a dozen stupid teenagers. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of stupid teenagers out there. So a dozen of them do something stupid and put a video up on YouTube and it's a national crisis. No, it isn't. I mean, come on, what are we going to do? Next we're going to hear that the kids who were eating the Tide Pods had come right from a rainbow party. I mean, this is another paranoid parental bullshit story.
Well, because everybody is a fucking nanny now.
Right.
This is a nanny nation. You know, I thought New York was really bad as being a nanny city.
Yeah.
Especially after you very cleverly snuck in the thing about a 32-ounce Big Gulp. I should have brought it up then, but you know what? It was so well done and so subtle, I let it slide through. But yeah, you can't have a 32-ounce Big Gulp because, I don't know, because Mayor McCheese said so.
Right.
But this is a nanny city, and I'll tell you what, if your kid is stupid enough to eat a Tide Pod, then you ought to be put down with the kid for being a stupid parent and a negligent one at that. You didn't teach your kid from the time that the little retard could walk, don't eat soap, especially laundry detergent, in any format. You know, the fact that they're actually putting out part of that video, by the way, was to show how Tide Pods and other laundry detergent pods are now in these sealable plastic bags and put it up on a shelf. But you're showing little children, toddler-sized. Toddlers are not the ones eating the Tide Pods.
No, no.
It's fucking teenagers. What part of this are you not getting clearly?
Yeah. Well, and I remember, there were kids that I remember hearing about when I was in school as a little kid who had to go get their stomach pumped. Kids who were in my class. You know, I'm not talking about, Bobby's cousin's neighbor's wife told him. No, these were kids who were in my class who did something stupid and drank motor oil or some dumb shit like that. And kids, little kids like that, do that occasionally. And there's even a disease called pica that makes people eat stuff they're not supposed to eat.
Usually lead paint chips.
Yeah, exactly. So that exists. But again, it's not a national crisis. It's not something we all need to pull our hair out about and change the world over. All you need to do is be careful. And if you have a toddler, cabinet locks might not be a bad idea for the poison.
Right, but we're not talking about toddlers eating this stuff.
Right.
We're talking about, quote-unquote, and I'm using the term really loosely, fully developed teenagers, which is an oxymoron in and of itself.
Right. Now,
hand in hand with that, yesterday on Facebook, a friend of mine had posted this absolutely brilliant video. It was a spoof, of course, but this absolutely brilliant video of a millennial job interview. in which this dumb little bitch, because I'm going to use that phrase because I think it's very appropriate here, pulls out every cliched stop from the thread of millennial cliches on a job interview. And at the end, she says to the potential boss who says to her, "I'm sorry, but I don't think this is going to work." And she says, "Are you firing me?" After she does her whole litany of things. And
you don't have a job yet.
She does it all in that voice where if you've ever had a conversation or unfortunately had no choice but to have a conversation with a millennial, everything they say comes out sounding like a question.
Right.
You know, where their voice lilts upward at the end of the sentence and there's a certain timbre and rhythm. It's always a patronizing and condescending sound that these little shit stains make. As you can tell, I'm not a fan of millennials. I personally think we should build camps for all of them and just not waste any time. You know what we need to do with them.
Right.
We need to force feed them all Tide Pods. But this thing is up and it's hysterical and it's brilliant. And of course, she says something about, "I'm feeling really uncomfortable now. You know, I don't feel very safe."
Yeah, right. I'm being triggered.
Yeah, well, huh. Well, I decided, you know, you're brilliant and I shared this. And somebody who is a musician of not note, let's put it that way, he was the only one who voiced his discontent by saying, "Well, to be ageist is asinine and it makes you sound like a douchebag about it." Keep in mind, he had a minor hit single and, you know, he's also pissed off a lot of mutual friends of yours and ours who are musicians and, you know, along the way. Yeah, we all liked his one hit song, but that's it. It was a minor, minor hit.
Yeah.
I nuked that response, but my reply was when posting this, it says, quote unquote, "This is so fucking accurate and why I loathe these little shits. I'd like to feed Tide Pods to the majority of them." And then somebody said, "I sense your hostility. This is a very funny bit." And I said, "If the words triggered and safe space are ever uttered around me, someone's noggin is going to meet my friend Louisville Slugger."
Somebody's getting slugged. Yeah, absolutely.
And the final capping on it was me saying, "Millennials, Jesus Christ, this is the result of not using birth control." Very simple. This is why tubes should be tied. We should have forced sterilization. Or parents should be put down along with their kids, just for the safety and the sake of the human race. Because it's bad enough we are basically living in idiocracy right now.
Right.
This just feeds right into the future of it.
And my dad told me when I was very young, he said, "The world isn't safe and life isn't fair. Get used to it and learn how to deal with it.
And don't eat Tide Pods."
Right, yeah. It was that. You know, it was like you bear responsibility for yourself at all levels. So, yeah, go out there and do whatever you can, but recognize the world doesn't give a shit about you.
Wait, John, did you just impart good common sense wisdom from your dad?
From my dad, I know.
Take responsibility for yourself?
Right. I know. It's
insane. This is the world of, you know, my kid can do whatever he wants.
Uh-huh.
Really? Well, guess what? My foot can do whatever it wants. Foot, meet this kid's head.
Not only can the kid do whatever he wants, everything he does is magic and wonderful. And it's a little apple of gold, and the world should be happy to have it.
The only apples of gold are the ones that come out of my ass in the morning.
That said, now, there are a couple. Oh, you know, the other thing, speaking of, there's a flip of that. In fact, there's two things that I want to spin off of that because one thing did happen this week and I was ready to throw my computer out the window. And then I thought, wait a minute, maybe I should find out what actually happened because there was a girl, and I want to say it was in Alabama, who was not suspended, expelled. Remember that word? She was expelled,
yes.
Expelled from school because she ran around on Martin Luther King Day calling everybody a nigger. So they said, "We've had enough of you. You're out and don't ever come back." And the headline said, "Girl offends people, blah, 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 you're expelled from school." And then mother, dot, dot, dot. And he had to click on the article. And I was ready for, "And mother sues the school and blames everybody and, you know, throws a fit." No. Mom said, "Good. She deserved it. We've been trying to get this girl under control for years, and she finally is getting what she deserves." And the mother backed the school. Now, I don't know how this girl was raised, but the fact is, at least finally, somebody with a half a brain said, "Yeah, you know what? Now they're going to have to deal with the shit they just pulled themselves."
Wait, and did you say Alabama?
Yeah, I know.
Holy shit.
Crazy, right? But the other thing, though, is, and this one drives me absolutely crazy. On the flip side of taking responsibility for yourself is something that we have heard more and more of, especially lately, because corporations and organizations have found a way to absolve themselves of any responsibility. And where it came up this week was in that, I don't even remember the guy's name, because every time I see his face, I want to kill him. The doctor for the U.S. girls gymnastics team.
I know who you're talking about, that creep.
Yeah. And
he looks like your sketchbook archetype of a kid toucher.
Right. Exactly. He looks like Peter Lorre fucked Stephen Miller, that guy from the White House.
Yeah.
He has been going through his sentencing phase, and he's never going to see the light of day again, which is fine with me. All of the women who were girls at the time who he molested have come forward to give their spiel, which is great. You know, and they get to say it directly to him, and good for them for being brave enough to face this guy and say, look, you asshole, this is what you did. So Michaela Maroney, who was a huge star from that team, also did. And the way this worked was she had signed a non-disclosure agreement, and these things I hate. So she signed an NDA and violated it by speaking at his trial, because that's public speech. So the U.S. The USA Gymnastics had the opportunity to fine her for violating the non-disclosure agreement. And a bunch of Hollywood stars stepped up and said, if they fine you, we will pay the fine for you. Don't worry about it. We got your back on this one. So Hollywood finally did something right this week too. But then finally USA Gymnastics relented and they said, no, we're not going to fine her, even though she violated the NDA. When, again, is common sense going to reign in this thing? I understand non-disclosure agreements in terms of trade secrets. Okay, if you work for a chemical company, you can't go out and publish all of their chemical, formulas. If you work for USA Gymnastics, you can't go out and tell people, this is how we train, this is what we do. You know, you can't give away techniques, you can't give away secrets. But how in the hell do non-disclosure agreements cover illegal activity? It seems to me that's the line. If somebody is doing something against the law, you should have, I don't care what you signed, you should have every right to go out and scream it at the top of your lungs on the street corner.
No, I totally agree. That's, but again, John, you are being rational and speaking common sense. And in a moment where that seems to always take the second stage, it's always pushed into the background, because more often than not, histrionics and fallacies seem to rule the roost. People want an op-ed. People want a photo op. People want a soundbite. People want something that they can show on the news or that a magazine can print because it's a story, you know? What you're talking about is, you know, these are grave situations. These are not funny. These are not incidents that people really want to have splashed on the front page.
Yep.
They're unfortunately stories that need to be heard. You know, when you get stories of D-lister, and I'm using the term very loosely, celebrities being tagged for sexual harassment because, you know, they didn't know at what point a potential star fucker didn't want to fuck after all, suddenly it becomes sexual harassment.
Yeah. You know?
But prior to this little incident that you get yourself mired in, you were over there saying, well, I'm a feminist too, and men are horrible. Well, first of all, you ain't getting back your dick. Now right. You own a vag, and you're going to have to live with it for the rest of your life because you sold yourself and the rest of your brethren out. I don't have time for that, and I don't want to hear about it. That's non-stories to me. You know, all this is part and parcel of a bigger group of people who just love the self-congratulatory bullshit.
Right.
All of it is glad-handing. And it's something that you've touched upon many times, the whole join my gang, march under my flag, wear my hat, or else. Homie, don't play that. Okay?
I just remembered what it was that happened yesterday that didn't happen. So now, here's the thing, though, as it would seem obvious and common sense, like you said, nationally or for state legislatures to say non-disclosure agreements do not cover illegal activity. Right now they do. You can't, even if it was a crime, you cannot talk about it publicly if you sign an NDA and they're enforceable. But for the legislatures to get together and say an NDA becomes unenforceable as soon as illegal activity was witnessed is the obvious thing to do. And I mentioned that to my producer for my radio show. And he said, well, you know why they don't. And dopey me went, no, why? He said, because they're the ones who benefit from it. Think of how many congressmen are out there screwing pages. And then it becomes real easy to see why nobody in the Congress wants to see non-disclosure agreements have a loophole for illegal activity, because then their illegal activity will become public.
Well, they should have thought of that in the days of when, oh, let's say, Democratic big mouth Barney Frank was screwing pages.
Exactly. Yeah, you remember the scandal during the Reagan administration with the congressional pages, and it went all the way through the girl that was murdered, and even though it wasn't the congressman who murdered her, you know that
his name was Mudd, Gary Condit, and Chandra Lee.
Exactly right. Yeah, he still lost his career over all of that, and he should have. I mean, I don't have any problem with that. But still, yeah, this kind of activity, you have to believe if it goes on in Hollywood with all of the quote-unquote power brokers, and you know how much I hate that word, out there, that it's got to still be absolutely rampant on Capitol Hill.
Well, you know, this isn't about, drowning in the V. It's all about power and I forgot the rest of that spiel that was on somebody's Facebook wall, and somebody definitely who doesn't have a sense of humor.
Right.
But as somebody had put very brilliantly and to the point, I'll remember to tell that to an alcoholic that, booze doesn't have anything to do with the alcoholism.
Right. Well, and we do have things to get into outside of all of this, because there was a movie, and I remember talking to you about this at the time. Had the opportunity a couple of weeks back to talk to the man who directed both of the 5 years documentaries on David Bowie. David Bowie, yeah. 5 years, and David Bowie, the last 5 years. You had the opportunity finally to see David Bowie, the last 5 years. What did you think?
I have to be honest. I found it probably a little bit more interesting than the first one.
I agree.
Here's the reason why I didn't care for the first one. Very simply put, it wasn't the first 5 years. Because if you did the first 5 years, it would have started in 1964.
Right.
Because if you go back and trace David Bowie's career from the very beginning, it's far more interesting than the glam rock years. You saw that he was really just a guy, and I like Bowie, don't get me wrong, but he glommed onto anything and everything that was the flavor of the moment. You know, the first single, which I think is absolutely fantastic and people forget it, is Davy Jones and the King Bee's Liza Jane, which is as catchy as the day is long. That's 1964. So the first 5 years are 64 to 69, and I think that's when he put out some of his best material.
Yeah.
Whether it was either with the King Bees, or then when he did You've Got a Habit of Leaving with the Lower Third, produced by Shel Talmy, and it sounds like a Shel Talmy production because it sounds like a combination of The Who and The Creation, Shel Talmy's other two great bands after the Kinks. It's got that, especially with the Rickenbacker Slash It Up sound in the middle of it. Or when he moved over to Pi Records and changed his name to David Bowie, and then he put out a single like Can't Help Thinking About Me, or even better, I Dig Everything, where you finally hear him use a little bit of that soul sound.
Mm-hmm.
Onto 1967, where he put out what is to this day my favorite song that he ever did, a wonderful song called Love You Till Tuesday. Yeah, he sounds like Anthony Newley, and it's definitely a show/pop song in every respect of the word, but it's just so warm and catchy and it just feels so good to listen to. You know, that's the David Bowie I wanted to see, dug up in those first 5 years.
Not to mention that first 5 years could have ended up very nicely with a little song called Space Oddity that I'm pretty sure most people have probably heard.
And the thing is, he did two versions of it. And the first one wasn't a hit. And the second one, The bigger version, once he put it in the hands of Tony Visconti,
yep,
that's when it all changed, So those first 5 years are the real first 5 years. So it negates watching the Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane and Diamond Dogs and the Thin White Puke and all that kind of crap. we've heard it done to death, so it's not interesting at this point. The last 5 years is much more interesting simply because of the time frame in which he started to work again, he started to tour, and then he had that heart attack on his tour. And not long after that, things did start to go in a very negative direction for him physically.
Yep.
And the fact that he was able to conceal this very long terminal illness and make some very powerful and critically adored work, that said a lot about him.
You know, you could tell, too, that David Bowie, I think it's fair to say, in the early days and even all the way through the mid-70s, was kind of looking at himself from the outside. That's where all the playing with the image came from. You know, it was like, oh, what can I do with this character that I've created? And how can I mess with this? Let's see what we can fuck with next. And it was fun. It was fun to watch, and we got some great music out of it. This was a much more introspective and backward-looking David Bowie, that he wasn't dwelling in the past, but I think that we got some glimpses in that documentary that in some ways he was trying to make sense of it, that he was trying to sort of come to terms with this great body of work that he had put together and considering what it meant. And I think that's kind of cool.
I completely agree with you. And there's, you know, I think the most salient moment is when somebody asked him, you know, do you have any regrets over everything? And he said, with the exception of the years that I wasted on drugs,
right,
no. But at least, you know, you're taking it in one fell swoop and you're saying, okay, those years that I was blotto, you know, I wish I wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's great because the onus is on you. But, you know, let's stop and look at Bowie for a second anyway. You know, he kept going from musical style to musical style, not because he was chameleon-like, but because he was trying to find a niche where he could be a success. Who wouldn't?
Yep.
You know, especially in that era when you could do something like that. Who was one of his closest friends before either one of them were signed to a record label, and who was a complete contemporary of his when success found both of them? Mark Feld.
Right.
Right? Okay. So who had success first? It was Bolan.
Mm-hmm.
Because T-Rex had the hit singles before Bowie did, but Bolan, being his friend, gave him his producer. And that producer put some of his knowledge and style and production technique onto Bowie and made him as much of a success, and maybe in the universal sense a bigger success than Bolan.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's that Bowie was a guy who, like you said, you know, he was looking at himself as an outsider would look at him, and he was able to laugh at it all.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
Because I remember very clearly. There was an album, I know this is going to sound weird, but there was an album that came out in 1984 actually called Love You Till Tuesday. It was a compilation that London Records / Decca Records had put out of basically his singles during his years with the Decca labels. There was Vocalion Pop, which was the one that had the King Bees, and then the singles like Love You Till Tuesday and When I'm Five and the London Boys, which were on Derham and so on. And one of the singles that had come out initially in 67 and then got re-released when Ziggy Stardust exploded was a song called The Laughing Gnome, which was such a, you know, of course, at that moment, Bowie cringed when not only was it re-released, but it started shooting up the charts because, you know, this very serious artist was doing such a light piece of fare with, you know, Varispeed vocals. It sounded like a British chipmunk and so on and so forth. And the phrase used was, this was Bowie at his lightest, most joyful, until success wiped the smile off his face. And I think that always stuck with me because that's how I always viewed Bowie. You know, it's like he liked the success because he was able to do what he wanted to do musically and artistically speaking. But that success always came with that price of, well, he's Bowie. Now he can't escape the, what will Bowie do next? You know, it's like if Lennon were alive today. Well, if Lennon were alive today, I'd probably throw eggs at him for a start for being a fucking communist. He'd probably be supporting Bernie Sanders, so yeah. I'd really want to shoot him. But, you know, you pay a price when you're locked into a certain image. And I think Bowie was unfortunately pigeonholed, and he never was able to get out of it. Even when he just was able to kick all the BS off around the time of Let's Dance. Let's Dance in and of itself is a message. You know, it's like, you know what? Enough. It's the 80s. Stop with the heavy thinking. Stop with the overanalyzing. Let's dance.
Yeah. Well, and it's the second half of the sentence. Fuck art. Let's dance. So, you know, that's where that all came from. And you know, even at that time, even though it's so committed to its time, I just happened to hear Roll By on Sirius this week. Him and Mick Jagger singing Dancing in the Streets. And you know what? Yeah, it's cheesy and it's ridiculous, but it was so much fun.
It was cheesy. It was ridiculous. God damn it. It was fucking white.
Exactly.
You know, look, there are some things that I cannot abide. That was one of them because those two guys are just so fucking white.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, oh man. I mean, at least, you know, here's the thing. Bowie did an album that never got officially released called Toy. And it was, I don't know if you know this album, but it was an album full of remakes of his own early stuff. So now we're talking about him redoing songs like Liza Jane and I Dig Everything, except now with that older Bowie crooner voice.
Okay.
No! No! Because at least in the 60s, you tried to show a little bit of soul and some balls and some moxie when you're singing it, you know, because you're trying to emulate your heroes, whether they be black or white. You're trying harder, you know. I don't need to hear a 56-year-old Bowie doing a I dig everything. No. Just stop.
Okay, I'm glad I haven't heard it now. Now, that's not the only movie that you got to see this week, especially as concerns rock and roll, because you also got to see there's a new Sting Live DVD out. And I know your opinions of him are not the absolute highest. He is not your favorite artist. He is not the pinnacle or the end-all be-all as far as Rob Ross is concerned. But how's the live DVD?
We're going to do this in two ways. Look at from the fan point of view, from the musical point of view, okay, and from the basic critic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's excellent because it is a complete complement of songs, and it's a very full show. Those guys are incredible players. Absolutely magnificent on the one, crackerjack playing, musicianship, skill.
Yeah.
You call it what you want. He's got a golden voice.
He does put together a hell of a band, you're right.
And he put together a hell of a set. And this is now a solo set predominantly that's over 30 years. Never mind the prior 10 with that band of his. you know, you couldn't ask for more because some of the song choices, if you know, whether or not you're a Police fan or if you're a Sting fan, but I mean, you're going to get the proverbial classics. But the fact is, my biggest problem is simply that he's so unbelievably antiseptic, and this is so clinical.
Hmm.
It is the what I just said about white.
Yeah,
this is the most soulless kind of show there is. This is an exercise in great musicianship. It could be anyone. I'm not denigrating the musicianship. I'm saying when you see a performer, you want to see them show some
sweat.
You know, sweat and balls and, you know, you want that kind of – you want them to fuck you good and hard the right way.
Yeah, right.
Not the way Todd Rundgren did. You know, you're ready for a good dickin',
yeah.
You know? This is more like a glass of wine and a handshake good night. You know, that's it.
It's not a rock show, right?
Right. I mean, and the thing is, this was his first rock and roll style tour in over a decade because this was the tour for the last album, 57th and 9th, which happens to be, by and large, a really great album and a consistent one at that, which is very hard to come by from him. There are maybe one or two songs that, in typical Sting fashion, get a fucking editor or don't use these lyrics. Because he has just always been one of the most atrocious lyricists on the planet. Between the pretentiousness and preciousness of his prose, it is phenomenal as it's so off-putting. You know,
yeah.
I don't think he ever got any lower, probably, than I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying. On Mercury Rising.
Yeah.
That's the one that just makes me cringe more than any other thing he's ever done. Although Pretty Young Soldier on this album is definitely cringe-worthy. And only because of a couple of lines, but it's still, they're so clumsy. the bottom line is this. If you're a fan of Sting, you're going to love this show because he brings it. The problem is he doesn't bring it and then stay afterwards for the post-coital cocktail. He just brings it and just, like I said, it's a glass of wine and a handshake and good night.
Yeah, that's too bad because he does have the ability to do it. And, I mean, where's that kid with the Stratocaster who was out there all by himself in the secret policeman's other ball? Just a castaway. That to me is what I want to see when I see Sting on stage.
This is the guy who's busy, you know, patting himself on the back for getting an OBE or something like that, and yeah, still talking on and on about Kundalini yoga and how great it is for his sex life with Trudy Styler. Gordon, enough.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm never going to refer to him as Sting anyway. He'll always be Gordon Sumner, whether he likes it or not. That's the name he was born with, son.
Little Gordy Sumner. So
Gordon Matthew Sumner.
Definitely something for the fans and maybe for the fans alone in the new Sting DVD.
Yeah, I mean, it's the exact opposite, really, of the Jeff Beck DVD we talked about in the last show. Because there you go. There's a guy who's been doing this thing for, you know, 50-plus years. And he still plays with just that joyful, youthful abandon. He doesn't go out there trying to be impressive and look at me. I'm in great shape and, you know, and I'm – ah, there's just something that leaves you completely empty from a Sting show.
Yeah. This is the reason why I love the fact that Iggy Pop is still out there doing performances. And, you know, it's like that one REM concert that I told you about that I saw on some overnight cable channel about 10 years ago. And it was a great show. And I thought, you know, it's so much different than when I saw them in 84, I guess it was, on Fables. But it was a great band, and they left it all on the stage. And I was a little surprised to see that because I had heard that some of the REM shows from that era, and that would have been early 2000s, were not good. They didn't give the audience really much of anything, but this was a terrific performance. And that's what you want to see.
You got lucky because I had friends that they kept cajoling me to go see them on the 2008 tour, the one that, of course, turned out to be the last official tour.
Yeah.
It was the Accelerate tour. And they went, and they, along with the critics, came away with the same consensus. Leave the political bullshit at home and fucking entertain us. Do the songs we want to hear. Don't preach at us from the stage. This is not what we're here for. This is not a political rally. Now, of course, Stipe being Stipe later on said, you know, well, I have a voice. I have a voice and I'm a citizen long before I was a celebrity pop figure, a rock star. The stage is my front yard, so I can put my sign in the front yard. No, you can't, because people paid a lot of money to see you.
Right.
You're doing them a disservice, and I don't care. And also, there are probably going to be people out there who have differentiating political views from you.
So, and that's not what you're up there to do. Right, exactly.
Entertain me. That's all there is to it. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb. Robbie Williams, there's a guy that never really broke and never broke, period, in the United States. The one time he toured here, I went to see him. I have never seen somebody sweat and work so hard to get his very small audience into that show. And when I tell you that was one of the three best shows I've ever seen anyone do, that still remains to this day. Why? Because he knew he was there to entertain. And what was his key song? Not Millennium, not Angels, Let Me Entertain You.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he did. And that's what you want, because right now, and this is, of course, a favorite theme of you and I and a recurring theme on this show, the cost of concerts are absolutely atrocious.
Oh.
And the last thing I want to hear is a favorite performer of mine preaching at me. I want you to fucking sing the songs that I paid to hear you sing live. That's why I'm never going to forgive Todd Rundgren, period. That will never be forgiven nor forgotten, you know?
Right. If I want to pay, not that I would, but if I wanted to pay somebody to jerk off in front of me, I would just pay somebody to jerk off in front of me.
Pretty much. I mean, you know, and hookers are a lot less, you know, less costly than a concert ticket.
Exactly.
You could probably get a small gaggle of them to do lots of dirty shit.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what we're all about, man.
The Cleveland Steamer. Sanchez.
Now
I never said this, I tell you.
You also
ebony and ivory motherfuckers. I tell you.
You also ran into a pretty good record this week, as I understand as well. Who are Cary Frank and Bruce Foreman?
There are a couple of jazz musicians, and I will say first and foremost, I had not heard their names before because they're both fairly young guys and they're both white dudes. And when it comes to jazz, my mindset is one place and one place only. 1947 to 1968,
yeah,
in the throes of modern jazz. And when I hear jazz, I think of very specific names. First and foremost, one of my absolute all-time heroes, Jimmy Smith at the Hammond B3 organ. You know, people like Donald Byrd, McCoy Tyner, Cecil Taylor, Coltrane, Brubeck. That's my era and preference and taste in jazz. And I realize, of course, Dave Brubeck is white. Yeah, I don't need to be schooled, people. I actually know what the fuck I'm talking about. But there's a point to be brought up here. So this album came to me. It's called Something to Remember Him By. And the first thing I did when the first notes came out of the speakers, I did a spin because I was thinking, wait a minute. Did I just accidentally put on my old Jimmy Smith albums? Because that's what it sounds like and feels like.
Okay.
This is not an exaggeration. This guy, Cary Frank, who's actually been the keyboardist in the Tedeschi Trucks Band for the last 6 or 7 years.
Hell of a player.
Wow. I mean, wow is probably undercutting it. And Bruce Foreman is just as bad of a motherfucker of a guitar player, playing note for note along with Cary Frank's, you know, Hammond B3 runs. That's all it is just the two of them. There's no drums, there's no bass, there's no embellishments. And the thing is that this album is so fluid and consistent, and it just the sound of it, it really, you would never know if you took out both volumes of A New Star, A New Sound, Jimmy Smith at the Hammond Organ, which came out in 1951 and 52 respectively on Blue Note. If you were to take those two albums out and play this album interspersed with it, you would never know who was doing what. That's how incredible this playing is. And the key about this album is most of the songs from this album are standards of that time period. Okay? We're talking about things like the September song, okay? Or Cole Porter's All of You, or Chet Baker's You Don't Know What Love Is. But the moment for me that really got me, and people will say, well, that's because you're old or you're fuddy-duddy or you're whatever. They did a rendition of one of my all-time favorite songs in the history of the world. Now, the song, the version that I loved was done by a singer named Frank Ifield. It was his only real hit in the United States. He had a couple of minor blips here. He was a bit bigger in England and certainly in his native Australia. There's a song called I Remember You. And it's an old Johnny Mercer song. It's an old standard. And that particular version was just, you know, it's a song that will live with me, you know, to my grave. They did it in the same way that, in fact, Jimmy Smith did it. In a very slow, very methodical. You can almost picture a candlelit lounge and bar, and you could hear it in the background. And it is no less touching and moving because just the melody alone is so powerful. But that made this album an A+, just because that song is part of it.
Yeah.
And my love for that song, it doesn't matter whose rendition it really is. It's a song that I will forever love. And I'll always appreciate you for doing it. But these two younger guys pulling this song off with such loose limbed aplomb is just phenomenal. All those songs. And the style and the production method in which it really does sound authentic. So full marks, kudos to this. It is called Something to Remember Him By, Cary Frank with Bruce Forman. This is one of the best new jazz albums I've heard, possibly since maybe Stanley Jordan's debut album.
Nice.
In 1995.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Another tremendously nice guy, by the way, who doesn't get nearly enough credits. Stanley's wonderful.
I'll tell you a very quick story. I remember when he used to play out in front of the Cube on Broadway. It was like 100, it's like around 125, 150 Broadway.
Yeah.
Out in front of the Red Cube playing, and I'd be like, wow, this guy's amazing. You know, he makes Eddie Van Halen look like a piker. And all of a sudden, I'm working in the record store, and there's his first album. On the newly reconstituted Blue Note at that time. So there you go.
Right. And you remember he was in Blind Date with Bruce Willis
and Kim Basinger.
And Kim Basinger, right. So, yeah, he did very, very well. And he still does. He still tours and makes his way around and is just as quiet and soft-spoken and polite and nice as you would imagine that he would be. He acts a lot like he plays. You know what I mean? If you listen to his music, that's the kind of guy he is.
He's but there you go. He was the last new jazz performer that turned me around.
Yeah.
Until this, because this album is one of those, you shouldn't miss it. It's a crime if you do.
Nope.
It's also irresponsible if you do.
No doubt. Again, that's Something to Remember Him By out from Cary Frank and Bruce Forman. And, you know, we look around ourselves, and we will get to the In Our Head segment here in just a little while, but there are a few things to hit between now and then. And I can't wait for this one, because I have been waiting for this one for all of 40 years. But, you know, we mentioned early on in this edition that the government shut down as of midnight two nights ago. Here we are on Sunday morning and getting ready for tomorrow, and I listened to about 5 minutes, because it's all I could stomach, of Chuck Schumer and that turtle-headed twat from the Mid-South, Mitch McConnell, and going after each other and blaming each other for all of this shit, and I care about the people who are not going to get paychecks and who are going to have to, you know, defer loans and all of that stuff for the next few, however long this takes. But aside from that, all of these assholes in Washington, I can't even listen to them anymore.
First and foremost, if Trump wants to truly do something of merit and value in this presidency, he will put into effect now an emergency presidential order that our soldiers get paid
yep.
and receive their benefits unfettered, uninterrupted, etc. Because our soldiers have always been the ones who've always been shat upon by our government collectively, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. We saw it when Bernie Sanders was running the VA and did nothing for them, and we're seeing it happen all over again. Now, Schumer and McConnell are no different. Those two are the biggest pieces of shit bookend motherfuckers I've ever seen in my life.
Right.
I'm not sure who – I probably hate McConnell just that little bit more, because he is such a duplicitous taint with those watery fish eyes of his and that look of, oh, I'm going to fuck somebody, but good. I don't care who, but I'm going to fuck somebody because I'm just that much of a scumbag.
Right.
And Chuck Schumer never met a camera, a photo op, and a session for crying that he didn't like. Always with the bawling and the fake you know, you're so full of shit. I can't tolerate you anymore. And thanks for ruining it for me with Cory Booker, because now he's taken a page from your book, because he's equally full of shit. Oh, my tears of rage. Oh, save it, T-Bone.
Yeah, and it's you know, this whole thing, they don't give a shit. And the one person you mentioned paying the soldiers, the one person who had the temerity to float that in the Senate before all of this started was Claire McCaskill, the Democratic senator from the state of Missouri, and she was shut down almost immediately. And that's the thing people need to realize.
By McConnell.
Exactly, and that's the thing people need to remember about this shit is how this procedure works. And, you know, when it comes to assessing blame, again, I don't give a shit, but there is a myth going around right now when they're saying that this is the quote-unquote Schumer shutdown, and the way the Republicans are trying to spin this is saying, well, you know, we can't do anything, even though we have the presidency and a majority in both houses, we can't do anything without 60 votes in Congress. But the problem with that line of logic is it leaves out the fact that nothing leaves committee without their approval, and they can shut down any proviso to any bill that they want to in committee, and it will never see the light of day. So, yeah, there is blame to go the Republicans' way, because the reason they can't get 60 votes in the Senate is all their own doing. It's all their own making. So they held back Chip on purpose, because they knew it will fuck any potential deal. They knew that going in. So they said, okay, well, we can hold this back. And that way, you know, when we hold Chip hostage and deny kids health insurance, well, then, you know, we can blame it on the Democrats. And it's all part of the game. That's the game the majority plays. It's their gambit. And they're the ones who are in control of every piece of it.
I'll tell you what, this is definitely, I would say, it's more the Republicans' fault because they're in control of the whole bag, but this is definitely a 60-40 split, you know? And, you know, the Democrats are there carping on, especially with Schumer, going on about, well, we care about DACA. Okay, you know what? Let's put paid to that concept once and for all. You know, there are a lot of people that went through hell, and that's probably minimizing, went through hell to come here legally and follow all the laws and all of the steps and everything that's entailed with becoming an actual American citizen instead of coming here illegally and then having a family, okay? Now, if you're being deported for being here illegally and you've been here for X amount of years, whose fault is that?
Right.
Okay? You've certainly learned enough in that amount of time of what the steps are. You can't make excuses. And if you've got, you know, college age or teenage kids, you really have been irresponsible and criminally negligent in that, without question. I don't care what country you're coming from. It doesn't matter. This applies to everyone and anyone who does this. Now, when people go on about how, oh, but he was brought here at an early age and he raised a family, yes, but did he ever apply on his own for citizenship? If he didn't apply for citizenship, unfortunately, he deserves to be deported too. Anyone here not legally should not be here.
Right.
We have had no end of problems with across the board illegal immigrants being here. We're not talking about specific groups. We are talking about anyone and everything. I don't care if you're a Russian who came over sneaking over on a sardine boat. I don't care if you're an Israeli who came over here in a tin of dates. I don't care if you're a Mexican who came over here in a lettuce truck. Did you apply for citizenship?
Right.
And did you take the time to learn that it's going to take you a while possibly to obtain it, but did you go through the steps? If you didn't, you have to go.
And the thing is, yes, there are complicated stories and there are nuances to all of these stories, but you know what? Everybody's story is complicated. Everybody's story is nuanced. So to pretend that somehow those complications and those nuances don't exist for the rest of us, you know, that we don't all have struggles and shit that we're dealing with, is fallacy. And that's part of the problem, is that, you know, the Democrats think that all you have to do is bring up somebody's difficulty and garner some sympathy for them, and it proves your point. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. All it does is point out that life is complicated.
And life is unfair.
Right.
And listen, I have friends. I had a friend here who came here a decade ago, and it took him almost that decade, even though he did it almost immediately, put in for citizenship of the United States. Okay. Right. And at the time that he came here, he wasn't married or any of that kind of stuff. Yeah, that he married an American woman, got him a green card, but he had already applied for citizenship upon arrival. He wasn't a political refugee. He didn't come in here, you know, illegally. He came here, you know, initially on a work visa, and he said, I want to stay here and become an American citizen. It was that simple. It took him over a decade, but he was sworn in as an American citizen.
Yeah.
Okay? He went through the steps and the channels the right way. It's time consuming, yes. It's a little nerve-wracking because of the amount of time that it will take, because it's not always that 7-year period. But if you do it the right way, you're not going to be deported. You will always be able to either renew your visa or extend your green card, whatever the situation is. When you do things in an illegal fashion, there are consequences, whether you come here illegally or you commit a basic crime. And this is what we're seeing more and more of. And I'm sure that as time goes by, apart from seeing people being deported in droves, and rightfully so, I'm saying that, justifiably so, we're also going to start hearing about lawsuits coming up because people have been accused of crimes that they didn't actually commit because what they did was not a crime. A compliment towards someone is not sexual harassment.
Thank you, yes.
And I'm sorry, all this nonsense about, and you this is a phrase I know you hate, strong women. No, okay, well, I'll tell you what. Next time a woman in the office asks you to get that big, heavy box down from that top shelf, say, I'm sorry, but I can't. You're a strong woman. You can get it yourself.
You know, it's funny you should say that because on Friday of this week, there's a young lady who works in our office who is probably about a foot shorter than me, and I outweigh her, I'm sure, by 200 pounds. So she was trying to pick up this box, and I said, let me get that for you. And it was full of cleaning supplies. It was heavier than I thought it was going to be by the size of the thing, and carried it into the kitchen for her. You know why? Because she's nice, and I like her. She's a good person, so I did something nice for her. That's all it takes. And, you know, my mom raised me well enough that when I see somebody in a situation like that, if it's somebody who's worth helping, I help.
Yeah, but you were also raised in the same atmosphere I was. If a woman's going through a door, you actually open the door and hold it open for her and say,
"Damn right." After you.
And when they give you a dirty look, then you just say, "You're welcome."
Exactly.
And usually I do mutter under my breath the magic word "cunt," but that's, you know, I'm like that with anybody who doesn't say thank you, and that goes for men too.
That's right.
Thank you, a part of the lexicon, and if you've negated it, you can go fuck yourself royally.
Got one more thing to get to before we get to In Our Heads this week, and it takes us to the movies.
Let's all go to the movies.
But we did go to the movies this week and saw something that I is not exactly in my
wheelhouse.
Yes, thank you. And I didn't know anything about it. I went in deliberately. I've been told that if you don't see movie trailers, it can actually make the experience better for you. So I've been trying to avoid them. And I knew nothing at all about the movie The Greatest Showman, except for the fact that the subject matter was P.T. Barnum. And I always thought he was kind of an interesting character. So I went in knowing zero about this movie. And this is the Hugh Jackman thing, and it's a musical, which I did not know. Laugh at me if you will. I had no idea it was a musical.
It's a musical starring Hugh Jackman. Ain't that a surprise?
Exactly. So the first thing that struck me about it is, you know, yes, it glosses, and it's taken some criticism. I looked this up afterward for the fact that it glosses over a lot of the sleaziness that P.T. Barnum was all about. It's a musical. Of course it does. And the other thing is, I knew already because I've seen some of the Broadway stuff that's made its way, onto cable and things like that, that Hugh Jackman's a hell of a performer. But it's a fairly entertaining movie. For an hour and a half, I was not unentertained. It goes back to what we were talking about with the rock performers. It was fun. You know, so okay. Was it the greatest movie I've ever seen? Did it move me? No, but it was pretty entertaining for an hour and a half.
Well, I'll tell you something. Now that you've brought that up, last night, Liz and I were doing our usual Saturday, let's hopefully find a movie to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And we found one called Happy Death Day. Now, I've mentioned this before.
I know about that one, yeah.
I'm a huge fan of horror slasher butcher movies. And, you know, they'll give me an occasional chuckle.
Yep.
The premise of this one, which I knew about and I'm sure you knew about, was basically it's Groundhog Day mixed with Friday the 13th.
Right.
Okay. Entertaining as the day is long. Genuinely funny. I mean, really funny. Completely clever. They worked the angle perfectly of it being Groundhog Day with a butcher knife.
Okay.
The girl who's the lead was just absolutely adorable. I mean, she was nice to look at for those, you know, 90 minutes. So that made it even all the more worth its while. I thought it was a great movie. I thought the way that they ended it was you know, a great twist. And this is one of those – I was very pleasantly shocked at how much I really just enjoyed it, how much it made me laugh. And then I looked it up after I had seen it, and sure enough, it was considered a comedy thriller.
Good.
So that's really that's the beauty of it. Now, I won't give the ending away, but there is one really fantastic moment at the very, very end that really doesn't have anything to do with the plot that just unfolded, but it just puts it all in perspective. And I thought, you are brilliant for adding this in. You know, I think using that device is absolutely spirited.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because it's so ripe for it, that slasher film idiom, and to make a comedy out of movies like that is very difficult to do. It seems like it would be easy because it's an obvious thing to hack on. But you look at how many of them have been done badly. Yeah, hack on. Right. I did that accidentally. But you'd think it would be easy, but you look at how many times it's been done badly and how many times those comedies just flop. And it's not, because they try to go over the top with it. The ones where it's done really well are where it's extremely clever and it's more understated. They don't slap you in the face with the jokes. And I'm thinking here specifically about movies like Shaun of the Dead.
And Evil Dead.
And
Evil Dead, if you're going to go into that original genre of the slasher, maybe unintended comedy,
right?
As it were, because now if you watch Ash versus Evil Dead on Stars, it's obviously a comedy and it's hilarious.
When in Evil Dead 2 was much more obviously a comedy, but yeah, you're right. There was plenty of humor in Evil Dead. There was plenty of comedy in American Werewolf in London, which is, I mean, still my favorite horror movie of all time. They have to let you up sometimes. And that's where that comedy relief comes in. I mean, when after the initial attack, when David's still laying there in the hospital bed and the American consulate guy comes in and it's Frank Oz and he's doing the Fozzie Bear voice. That's hilarious shit. But the one that I've seen, and I'm looking forward to seeing Happy Death Day. It's been recommended to me a couple of times. But the one that before that goes back maybe 7-8 years, there's a movie called Tucker and Dale versus Evil. Have you seen this?
Oh, my God. Yes, I have. I think it came to me. I think you and I actually had a conversation about this on Overnight America.
I love that movie so much. It's so funny. I mean, and the thing is, they play with every horror movie trope and turn it on its head, and it's ridiculously funny, but it's, you know, it also doesn't shy away from spraying the camera with blood either. So, you know, it stays true to itself while it's having fun. It's a charming horror movie.
Whereas American Psycho is just a goddamn funny movie. And it's also a really funny book. Now, I always thought Bret Easton Ellis is a shitty author, frankly.
Right. Yep.
Because Less Than Zero was garbage. But because of the buzz that went around with American Psycho, I bought it and read it when it came out. And, of course, it made me laugh. Whether that was intended or not, I'm not sure.
It was.
But because people made such a stink about it, they did with that book what they had done previously with Gore Vidal's Life from Golgotha. And basically, you know, let's burn this book. And let's buy copies of it so they can burn their fingers while burning it.
Mm-hmm.
This movie caught some of the same flack. But when you watch the movie, it's so much more over the top that the comedy becomes so heavy duty and obvious to me that it loses the really funny edge. Save, of course, for the famous, do you like Huey Lewis in the news?
How do you feel about Huey Lewis in the news here?
Huey Lewis himself turned that one around and took it, you know?
Yeah, well, and...
You know, we've seen with him and Weird Al.
When Christian Bale got the script for that movie, for American Psycho, he didn't know anything about Bret Easton Ellis' novel. He didn't know anything about the story. All he knew was another script landed on his desk. And he said he was very reluctant to say yes immediately. And the director called him and said, what's the holdup? And he said, well, I don't know if you realize it, but this script is hilarious. And that's how he ended up getting the job. That's how he ended up landing the part, because the director was like, yeah, you got it. It's supposed to be. It's supposed to be funny.
You know, the original choice for the longest time was supposed to be for Patrick Bateman.
Uh-uh.
one of the most unfunny, irritating human beings on the planet, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, that would have been horrible.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been unpardonable.
Yeah, that's probably why he didn't get it, because he didn't understand what the movie was, and Bale got it from reading the script. He was like, this is great.
Yeah.
Which brings us very nicely to the In Our Head segment, because this week was an anniversary, and we haven't done a lot of these in the In Our Head segment about particular anniversaries, but this one was a high watermark of a career that, again, spanned 40 years plus, maybe 50 years plus, because in 1978, 40 years ago, as of the 18th of January, the album Excitable Boy was released. And to look at Zevon's career and say that there could have been one album that was seminal is almost, it's almost heartbreaking, because there was so much good music on all of them. But when Excitable Boy came out, not only did you have the title track, you had Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, you had Werewolves of London, you had
Guns and Money.
Yeah, Lawyers, Guns and Money. I mean, it goes on and on and on.
Isn't it Accidentally Like a Martyr also on there?
Yes, it is. And And so it's an incredible piece of work from beginning to end. And, you know, I was just going through it and thinking, you know, that was not just because of Werewolves of London every freaking Halloween, but that album, because of the strength of the songs on it, was really the one that got me into the camp of a true fan of Warren Zevon. So I figured I'd hand it back over to you and ask you a little bit, first of all, about your memories of some of the cuts on that album. Do you have one that's associated with it? And what do you consider to be the track that defines that record?
I have several memories of that record, and certainly of his music going back to that record. First is the first time I ever heard Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner was on WNEW radio when it first got released. It was Scott Muni who played it. And I remember, and I had a friend in high school named Rick who we pretty much would listen to the radio at the same time, you know, independent of one another, and then talk about it the next day at school. And I said, did you hear that song by Warren Zevon? And all of a sudden, he just started singing it. He goes, I already bought the album.
Headless body stalking through the night in the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun. In the muzzle flash of Roland's Thompson gun.
Yeah, like, what? You know, because you need to hear the album in total. You know, so that's of course my first recollection of it. And then I realized later on that he was the guy who wrote Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me for That was a hit version by Linda Ronstadt.
Right.
You know, who I was just totally smitten with. I didn't make the connections that he was part of that whole Laurel Canyon scene, or that, in fact, he was the guy that wrote Like the Weather for the Turtles, which was on the flip side of Happy Together on the 45.
Yeah,
that he had written his single Outside Chance, which is still probably the best thing that the Turtles ever did, except for She's My Girl.
Right.
You know, those two are neck and neck. So that was my introduction to Zevon. Later on, there's one that I'm really fond of. I was dating this horrific woman who just – she was an old lady even when she was in her 20s. And she had just the most appalling taste in music. But for some reason she liked Warren Zevon's music, which was fine. And we found out that he was playing, of all things, at what had been a good old-fashioned dinner theater, a cabaret in Sayreville, New Jersey, off Route 35, called Club Benet. And tickets were affordable, and we could get a table and dinner and drinks and see the show. And he was going to be doing an acoustic set. And this was 1995, early 95. We went to see the show, and sure enough, it was just a piano on stage and him with a 12-string acoustic guitar when he came out. And the first thing he says to the audience is, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to hell. My worst nightmare has now been realized. I'm doing fucking dinner theater. And he played for almost an hour and a half, if not more. And he gave you every song out of that fucking catalog.
Yeah.
Even songs like Even a Dog Can Shake Hands from Sentimental Hygiene. When he sat at the piano to do Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, forget it. The place went berserk. But the most striking thing about that show is I don't remember what song it was in particular, but he did a guitar solo. Remember, he only had a 12-string acoustic guitar. And I'm not kidding when I tell you he played that 12-string acoustic the way Hendrix played. I've never seen anyone pull off something like that with such unrestrained talent, just fueled right into his fingers. The last of it is there was a woman that I was seeing for a while who considered herself to be an absolute Zevon aficionado. She was completely bonkers for Warren Zevon. So when we were seeing each other, we would listen to a lot of it and a lot of his material. And I remember her saying the two things that she could never find on CD were Bad Luck Streak in Dancing School. She could never find it. And she could never find the first album, the very first one. Not the one on Asylum, but the album that he had done for Liberty, his first album. And I tracked the two of them down on CD and I got them for her. And she flipped out completely. Of course, she flipped out later on and broke up with me. which for a while I couldn't listen to Zevon, but you know, I also remembered, like, wait a minute, when she'd say things like, I think the Beatles are our band, like, yeah, you're not taking that from me.
You're right. Yeah, no, you don't get that.
You don't get the Beatles. No fucking way, sweetheart. So but yeah, my memories of Zevon are pretty good and warm. And the only one that I don't want to talk about or remember was that final appearance on David Letterman, because I can't watch it.
Yeah.
I can't. Not at all.
Well, and I've said this before. I have the VH1, The Making of the Wind, on DVD, and it's still in its shrink wrap. I will be ready to do that one day. I'm still not. And I'm with you. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the girl that broke up with you later, because Accidentally Like a Martyr, which came from that album, there's a version of that that's on Preludes. And Preludes was the posthumous release of all of the demos and all of that material, and it's fantastic. There's a version of Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me on there that rocks harder than anything else you've ever heard. It just blows the doors off. Version of Accidentally Like a Martyr that's on that album is completely different. The only thing that's the same is the chorus. That's it. Everything, the verses are entirely different words, entirely different music, and it's great.
Why'd I let you get to me again? You get me all confused. Can't I ever get it through my head? I'm only being used. Why'd I let you get to me again? Why'd I let you in, knowing you were only gonna nail me up again? Thinking mad love, shadow love, random love, and abandoned love, accidentally like a martyr. The hurt gets worse and the heart gets harder.
I was really impressed with it, and it made me wonder why he changed it so much. It's still a great song. But the memory that I have is of a girl that I was not supposed to be hanging around with very much. And we went out one night and drank way too much. And we're on our way back to where we were staying at the time. And that song was kind of a breakthrough in that relationship in a very odd way. Because while that song came on, even though she was about 30 minutes away from spewing everything she had eaten for a week all over the inside of my car and a roadway in Branson, Missouri. But when that song came on, she reached over and put her hand on top of mine, on top of the gear shift lever. And it was like, huh, okay, so I'm not in this alone. And so every time I hear that version of Accidentally Like a Martyr, I go right back to that moment in my car. And, you know, and it's... it's one of those indelible marks from a song that, even though it wasn't all that long ago, is still one of those that's going to be there forever and is going to be associated. Every time I hear that tune, that's where I'm going to go.
Of course. I mean, That woman that I just mentioned, the one I had dated, I remember her cracking me up one night because she played Hit Somebody and I hadn't heard it. And I just thought, this is a stroke of genius. And she said, this is why I love him and this is why I love you. You know, and it's, you know, you hear all these nice little things and nice little moments. But I remember there was a point, and our relationship was brief. It was only about 3.5 months long, but it was very poignant and very intense emotional roller coaster. And she had been in a very life-threatening situation in the hospital. And once she got out, on the first night where we could actually go out again, where she was up on her feet, we came back to her house and she put on, and I have to confess, I don't remember which track it was, but she put on a couple of Zevon tracks that were very slow and very, you know, and we just slow danced in her living room. You know, I just held her and it was very nice. Romantic. You know, considering she was, without a question, evil incarnate. I mean, she is, you know, now I know why 99% of everybody who's ever known her, when you say her name to them, the magic word appears right afterward, coming out of their mouths. And these are people who would never stoop to using such a vulgar term. And when we broke up, I have to admit, that was the first moment when the light bulb finally went on over my head. And I thought, now I understand why everyone hates you. Because you are.
Attaboy. Well, we're going to leave it at that and look forward to our next conversation. As a matter of fact, our next In Our Heads segment is going to build off of that, because that song, the hockey song, or Hit Somebody, is one that has a lot of great stories behind it. And it's also one of those tracks that, because it's a voice that you don't recognize until somebody tells you who it is, then you go, oh, fuck, of course it is. The Hit Somebody chant in that song is David Letterman.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, wow. That's Dave singing that. And in fact, it was Paul Schaefer doing most of the music, including, I mean, it's obviously him playing the keyboards, but he played a lot of stuff on that track. And so every time you hear that, Hit Somebody, that's Dave saying that. But we'll like I said, we'll build off of that for our next In Our Heads. And Rob Ross, have yourself a hell of a week. By the way, right now, it is, as we record this, halftime in the AFC Championship game, and the New England Patriots are now losing 14-10 to the Jacksonville Jaguars. I hope that holds out. We shall see next week.
You know, usually I open my big mouth, as I am wont to do, and I make one of these proclamations. I'm just going to be quiet and just quietly hope for a turnout that I think would be very satisfactory to everyone in this country.
There you go. Rob Ross, have a good week, man.
You too, brother. I'll see you later.